Once more unto the breach, dear friends, else close the wall up with our English dead.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and welcome to another sort of semi-almost and kind of exciting episode of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jake and...
Jeff.
McClure. We are coming...
Yeah, I can say my name.
Yes, we should both be congratulated. I don't know about anyone in our listening audience, but on a Saturday morning, saying your own name is, especially on cue, is quite demanding. I don't know if anyone else has that experience or if it's just we have coordination issues. What do you think?
I think we have coordination issues.
Well,
I know I have coordination issues. You can speak for yourself.
Well, I think we should get on with the cancel culture and cancel our coordination issues.
What that sounds think? Cool.
Yeah,
that'd be good.
We'll just get together with a group of people and laugh at them and make them go away. I don't think it'll work, but we can try it. It works for actors, and you really don't want to have actors doing things other than acting. So, anyway, this is the Personal Wealth Coach. And as strange as it may be, two economists are going to talk to you on your weekend, unless you change the channel or switch out of the podcast. If you're on the podcast, it may not even be the weekend, which is again strange. I don't know why you've chosen to spend your time with us. We do appreciate it, though we definitely doubt your sanity. Welcome to the club. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. I'm Jake. He's Jeff. We're both bald. We're both bearded. His beard is white. Mine is mostly black with some white in it. And that's how you can tell us apart as we speak to you. We've got some disclosures to give because whenever you're talking about finance, you need to have someone speaking in monotone at high speed into your ear to tell you, don't believe anything that you're listening to unless you do believe it and then believe it wholeheartedly. We should make that one of our disclosures. What do you think?
I think so. I think that's, well, the faster you speak and the longer the words you use, you're probably the less people will listen to you, so it doesn't make any difference.
Yeah, we got to take the, like, all of the inflection out of our voice when we can just speak on a monotone this way very quickly. All right, so disclosure. Number one, this program's called the Personal Wealth Coach. That's a pretty good disclosure. Think we should stop there? That is also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm. Now, just because the firm is registered with the SEC does not say that the SEC is giving us any kind of approval. They don't do that. Their job is not approval, it's disapproval. So we haven't been disapproved yet. That's the only endorsement we can claim. But we do need to tell you that because they are the regulators of our firm. And if we do something completely dangerous to the public, they'd be the ones to talk about. Unless it's like running through traffic without any clothes on, there are other authorities for that. We're just talking about finance conversations, not streaking. Different things. Also, the firm being registered with the SEC for fiduciary advice as an investment advisor, we can't do that on the radio. The radio program can't give investment advice. Why?
Well, the program can't give investment advice without us, and it can't give investment advice with us either.
But right.
Yeah, I got you.
So we can't give investment advice to you as a listener because we don't know you, and that's one of the requirements of giving investment advice is actually know the person you're advising. I know that seems weird. We also, even if we do know you, and I think we probably know the two people that are listening at the moment, you and I.
Well, I think there's some other people listening too, maybe one or two. We haven't figured out exactly how many, but there's a certain resonation that indicates that somebody is actually listening to this radio program.
We hope. So all that being said, even if we do know you, there are some privacy issues about giving advice when a lot of other people can hear on the air or in a podcast. So we simply can't give fiduciary investment advice. So what the heck are we talking about if we can't be advising and that's our whole claim to fame? We're giving education. So that is those are two of the disclosures. You want to do the next ones?
Well, the information we provide on this radio program, educational though it may be, has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable and accurate. However, we make no warranty or claim to the reliability, accuracy, or completeness of said information. It was cool, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I said all that stuff without stuttering.
You got your demon on. A demon?
A demon. Yeah, I've got my demon. I should be able to go to law school after learning you say that.
I think that if you wish to spend your time going to law school, that is totally up to you, if you wish. Okay, next disclosure. Man, there's a lot of them. We don't pay for this radio program. This is not paid commercial advertisement. We don't get paid to do the radio program. We've been proudly doing this without pay, adding to the unemployment rolls for the past 24 years in your case. So we've been doing this a long time, not getting paid the whole time. I'm not sure. What is our incentive here? Education? Clients do listen to this. That's true.
I think momentum is the biggest piece of it.
Because we started and now we don't know how to stop?
Yeah.
I think that might be most of it. Because believe it or not, people that have tens of millions of dollars generally don't make their decision on who gives them advice based on listening to a radio program or a podcast. I know it's weird. You would think that that would be enough, don't you think? So our incentive here is multifold. Number one, there's not enough education out here on finance, so we're filling that gap as much as we can. And number two, we do have clients that listen to this that like to hear us talk. I know it's weird. There's no excuse given for the taste involved here. Hopefully, they're all heavily medicated. If they say they like to listen to our program, but there it is. Okay. So let's talk about what happened in the market this week.
Well, the market was weird this week, but that's not unusual. It floated around up and down. What was unusual is that it surged upward to break records on Monday. It fell on Sunday. Fell on Tuesday. Gradually climbed back up on Wednesday. Hit a new intraday record on Thursday, and then sagged again on Friday. Because it was getting conflicting information. Well, the market actually doesn't get information. It's the people who participate in the market that get the information, and they got a lot of it. And the information they got was very conflicting. So on one day they'd say the argument that's going on, and it's a classic argument between bears and bulls, is the economy sagging because of the new COVID infection rates? Is the Fed going to raise interest rates too much and crush the economy? Fed came out, by the way, and said, no, we're not going to do that. But a lot of people chose not to believe them. On the other hand, is the economy overheating and we're going to get runaway inflation, and the Fed's not going to raise interest rates quickly enough? And one commentary that I read in the Wall Street Journal put it very, very well. It said, institutional managers are looking for a reason to sell. And that's what's happening. And every time they go in with a reason to sell, they go, oh, there's the reason to sell. A bunch of individual investors primarily come in and buy up in the dip, and the market rises again. And the institutional managers shake their head and said, well, we screwed that one up. The market actually dipped after zigzagging around and being so violent and contrary during the week. It 0.37% fall in the S&P 500 for the week, which is next to nothing. It's 0.37%. It's up over 17% year-to-date, up 1% for the month of July, which is cool. And we haven't been giving the annual numbers, the numbers from last year. But last year, the recovery was pretty well underway at this point. So the S&P 500 is up 34% from where it was this time last year. We also follow the CRSP Mid-Cap Value Index. And we do that because the main part, the five stocks, which are large-cap growth stocks, are based on potential future earnings. In the S&P 500, are largely 22% of the value of the S&P 500, and they're driving the train right now in the S&P 500. So at the other end of the spectrum in the S&P 500 are the mid-caps. They don't have small caps in the S&P 500. So at the other end of the mid-caps, and the other end of the other end would be mid-cap value. So I use the CRSP Mid-Cap Value Index as an indicator of what the other corner of the market doing. And this was interesting. It didn't zigzag up. It just was kind of saggy during the week. And then on Thursday and Friday, it jumped. And it was up 1% for the week. It's up 18.81% this year. And I guess in short, you could say that large cap growth stocks took a bit of a hit this week, not much, but they were the ones that were zigzagging up and down. At the end of the week, the smaller value stocks came back into favor. And if I could, Jake, I'd like to explain a little bit about that.
Oh,
basically.
But no, that's not why we're here. We're just here to confuse people. Just say numbers and don't explain them. That's the way everybody else does it. So I think we should do.
During the pandemic, the five large stocks called the FANGs, I don't remember whether they're Facebook, Alphabet, Google. Well, Alphabet is Google. What are the others? Amazon.
Apple. Netflix.
Yeah. Basically, there's a group of them in there, about five stocks that make up the driving force in the S&P 500 stock index. And the reason the market was sagging at the end of the week, at least a little bit, was because Amazon went down. And Amazon went down because they said, we've had record earnings, we've had record sales, we beat expectations for our earnings. Of course, that causes it to go down. But it also said, but we don't expect this kind of growth to continue forever. Well, as soon as a CEO says something like, we don't expect growth, outrageous growth to continue forever, then people start selling. On the other end of the market are the value stocks. And value stocks are based on a regular recovery, a normal recovery, not the weird recovery that we've had so far with people rushing to buy stuff in the electronics stores. In other words, a return to a normal cyclical economic cycle. Cyclical economic cycle?
Cyclical redundant. Cycles. That's repetitive and redundant. The cyclical cycle today is circulated.
If we get a little bit of inflation and we get a normal recovery, then the value stocks would rise in value. I like that. That was good. The value stocks would rise in value.
Yes. We're repeating ourselves regularly these days.
There's this battle going on between the value side of the market where normal recoveries are shown, things like utilities and railroads and old-fashioned places that actually earn money and have reasonable price-to-earnings ratios, and the upper end of the market that drives major bull markets where sometimes the price-to-earnings ratios are so high they're astronomical, where you take 145 years of earnings of some of the larger stock to pay for the price of the stock.
Sometimes more than that. At the beginning of the year, Tesla's price-to-earnings ratio was 1,700. Now, it's dropped quite a lot since then because the earnings have come way up, but still, 1,700 years to break even on an earnings, that's nosebleed territory for sure.
So, we've got a market that is seesawing back and forth between looking for a relatively normal recovery to assert itself and the market that, in the side of the market that's somewhat speculative that says somebody's got a tremendously wonderful idea and they're going to conquer the world, which is normal in a bull market. The other thing that's healthy in this bull market is the fear, and there's a lot of it. I mentioned that the institutional investors are looking for a reason to sell, and they're not fine. Every time they see something that looks like a reason to sell, they sell, and then somebody else comes in and buys, and they slap themselves on the forehead. But that level of fear in the market with people looking for a reason to sell indicates that there's a lot of cash still sitting on the sidelines because people aren't buying when they're looking for a reason to sell. Yeah.
And this kind of is a perfect segue because you're talking about something that's very timely. The value growth cycle happening right now is right this moment. This is more of a timeless question, but you've alluded to it here. And I got this question in the middle of the day yesterday from a podcast listener, Arlen. Thank you, Arlen, for listening, by the way. He says, hope all is well. One of the messages I've heard from you and Jeff over the last few episodes is that fear in the market is generally a good thing. The saying is to support that is bull markets climb a wall of worry. But I'm still not quite grasping why that's good. Does it keep the market from getting out of control? Thanks, Arlen. Okay, so Arlen, that's a fantastic question. And we have been remiss in not explaining this more. Sir John Templeton is the one that says bull markets climb a wall of worry. And he has a better, longer quote that is one of my favorites of all time when it comes to the psychology of the marketplace. And that is, bull markets are born on pessimism, mature on optimism, and die on euphoria. So if you take that as a microcosm, bull markets start on pessimism? How is that? Well, they start in the depths of a bear. That's how you start measuring this. We've had some kind of a collapse and that have extra money available to add to the system are what causes the bull to begin. They say, this is too cheap. I'm jumping and I'm buying this. Now, the people that are saying that have a great deal of hope in their hearts. Hey, I need to buy this. But they are outnumbered by the vast majority of people. And all you have to do is look at headlines. At the depths of a bear market, the headlines are about how bad things are. And at the top of a bull market, the headlines are about how good things are. Both of them include that this is going to go on forever, kind of mixed into the feeling of the message of this is horrible and this is the new normal. Or this is wonderful and this is the permanent plateau of economic prosperity, which is an actual quote from 1929 newspaper right before the massive crash that led to the Great Depression. Why is that? This is pure psychology. Why is it that worry is needed for a bull market to continue? And the reason is that if a lot of people are worried, almost by definition, they haven't invested yet, or they've gotten out of the market, which means there's more money to come into the market. This seems a little weird, but if you took a group of 10 people in a room and you said to them at any given time, how many of you think the market's going to do well over the next 5 years, really, really well over the next 5 years? If this group of people are normal investors, the people that answer that they think that the market is going to do well over the next 5 years are generally pretty well invested already. So you put your money where your mouth is in this kind of optimistic, pessimistic world. If there's a lot of pessimism, it's because people that are pessimistic out there think things aren't going to be good and almost by definition haven't put their money into the market or they've pulled their money out. So the more optimism you see out there, it's kind of a gauge for how many people have already put money into the market. And when everyone's optimistic about where the market's going to be, everybody's like, this is great, it's going to go on forever. Just about everybody's put their money in the market. Well, what causes the market to go up? People putting their money into the market. And if everybody's already done that, you've kind of reached the top. And if there's a lot of people that are still worried, then you still have a lot of movement where those people eventually get convinced based on the returns of the people around them. So this is pure psychology. When you're talking about tracking hurricanes or the stress of metals and how much it can put up with, that's pure physics. And you can look at momentum in physics as being a very different thing than momentum in psychology. Momentum in psychology is once you've been wrong in a crowd enough times, well, I think the market's going to crash next month. And you say that enough times and you've been wrong enough times, you change your mind and you say, okay, the market's not going to crash next month. It doesn't mean that it isn't going to crash next month. It's just that I've been wrong enough times, I'm going to change my mind now. So now the market's not going to crash next month. I'm putting my money into the market. And at some point, the last person does that, and that means that the market does crash the next month. And that's just the cycle of the market. There's a psychological aspect of this that leads people to make decisions not based on the reality of the moment. When we see headlines across the board that look at like what they do, like this week, we have productivity increases coming out from the Labor Department. And we see the market rocking all over the place, terrified of this, terrified of that. That means we're in good shape for the long term because there's still a lot of people that haven't put their money in the market.
Now, this productivity increases coming out from the Labor Department mean there are few people working in Labor Department doing more paperwork?
Yes, of course. That is totally what I meant. No. This goes on to a news release that's just come out from the Labor Department. They do that, by the way. They release news, and this is productivity and costs by industry, wholesale trade and retail trade. The retail trade sector had a 7.7% productivity growth over the last 12 months. Non-store retailers, what is a non-store retailer? Can you give me a guess on that?
A retailer that doesn't have a store.
Right. Non-store retailers generally are online.
They should be called warehouse retailers because they have warehouses.
They had a 19.6% productivity increase over the last year. Whoa, that's huge. That is a number that you just simply don't see in economics almost ever. 19.5% in sports, hobby, music instruments, and bookstores.
There's an important thing about productivity that I think people don't understand very well. I don't understand it very well, so I assume they don't either. And that is, there's two ways for the GDP to grow. Actually, three ways for the GDP to grow. If there's more people working, but first, there have to be people who want to buy.
Right.
Presuming you have a lot of people who want to buy, and we have that right now, then more people working more hours allows for growth in product creation and delivery, which is what the GDP is all about. Then productivity rising doesn't require more people and more hours. As a matter of fact, it indicates that there are fewer hours being worked to produce the same stuff and services that were done before, and that allows the GDP to grow too.
And that's kind of the kryptonite for inflation is productivity growth.
And we're having some amazing productivity growth over the last year.
Now, some of that growth comes because people weren't doing anything, but the non-store retailers, people weren't losing their jobs in that category. So to have a near 20% improvement in productivity year over year means that we've automated drastically. There are some areas where productivity decreased in the retail area. Gas stations had a 5% drop in productivity. Electronics and appliance stores, not online, had a 2% drop in productivity. And building material and garden supply stores had a 0.7% drop in productivity. What is that about? Well, the answer to that is that we've just had a huge surge in demand across gas stations. The people are going out and traveling at huge rates, and there have been layoffs in that area because, believe it or not, during the heights of the pandemic shutdown, there wasn't a lot of traveling going on. I know it's hard to remember back that far, but that meant that a lot of people got laid off from gas stations. And now, as the demand has come back, it's been harder to hire people for that, and they've been required to work longer hours. It's really hard to increase productivity when you're standing behind a counter. And that's your productivity, is that you're there to accept payments, and you actually need to hire more people to do the same amount of work because things were so easy to do last year at this time. So just keep that out there. The other, the big one here, and this is, it's a small decrease, but building material and garden supply stores. This is directly related to supply chain issues. The productivity dropped here because it was hard to get lumber for a long time. Prices for lumber went way up, and it wasn't just lumber, but building material and garden supply stores mixed all together. The biggest aspect of that was building supplies. The supply chain just got all kinked up, and it required a lot more people to get that unkinked. So you had a productivity drop. When you see that compared to motor vehicle and parts dealers, who, you know, we're talking about same kind of supply chain issues, they're automating fast enough that they had a 7% rise in their productivity. I know I'm geeking out over productivity, but you just said this. Supply and demand, I think most people understand. They say if there's a lot of people that want to buy something, the demand is up. And if there's not as much supply, that means the prices are going to go up. Okay, so if everybody wants to buy chocolate chip cookies and there's not enough chocolate chip cookies, the prices go up.
Actually, the price of Oreos is being documented very thoroughly, and it has gone up 15%.
Right. So supply and demand. There's not enough to go around. People want more Oreos. There's crack in them. Well, maybe. That's unverifiable. That did not come from a source we deemed to be reliable. It came from me. So supply and demand are important. But the other side of this, underlying even supply and demand, because you have to have people to have demand, and you have to produce stuff to have supply. Underneath that are two factors that you kind of have to get through 4 years of economics in college before you become aware of just how enormously important it is. And that's a very simple statement of productivity and demographics. You need to have an educated, fairly young workforce in order to have growth in your GDP. And it needs to be, hopefully, a growing population so that GDP growth is just built into the system. And then productivity means that they do need to be educated and they need to know what they're doing and they need to get better at doing it on a regular basis so that we continue to have growth. Those are the big pieces to GDP growth.
Unfortunately, we are hitting the wall on population growth. As a matter of fact, over the last year, our population growth has been zero.
Yes, and it's actually been slightly negative. And part of that is death from other things, but we've stopped immigration. We're having fewer babies than we have people existing. So if each couple doesn't have two kids, then you're not replacing the population, and we're having fractional kids per couple. I don't know how that's done yet. I don't know how it is that people are getting the 0.9 baby issue, but I see it in the statistics all the time.
I think I know what it is. It's pets.
You think it's pets?
Yeah, I noticed the signs on the highway that say if you see a pet or child in a car alone, you should get help. So we're equating pets and children.
Ah, maybe a pet is like a fractional person.
Maybe a dog is 0.3 children.
Well, every 15 seconds, a woman in America gives birth. Someone stop that woman.
That's no, don't stop her. Tell her to speed up.
Statistics are weird that way, but we have hit the wall on demographics, as have just about every industrialized nation on the planet. When you're doing well, when you're prosperous, you're not having as many babies, especially if you have the ability to not have babies. And that's kind of interesting, but it's something we're seeing across the globe.
The pandemic really slapped off. There is a dramatic decrease in productivity of women having babies.
Yeah, it's a different kind of labor department there. Where the labor department is productivity increase in labor is shortage in the demographic. You see what I'm doing there with a double entendre with the.
But there's a key. There's a key element here. We've hit this problem before in the history of the United States, where we've had low birth rates among people who were born here. And we've solved it and continued to grow by having increased immigration from Eastern Europe and from other places. It's always been resisted by the folks who are there. Benjamin Franklin resisted it because it was the Scots-Irish coming in, and he didn't want any of them coming into the country. But we have a choice. We can either go the route of Japan and China, which are headed towards a brick wall when it comes to demographic growth. They'll go into shrinking populations here very shortly.
Why do we use an allegory for a brick wall? Why can't it be like a timber wall or log wall or grass wall?
Timber walls and log walls are a lot softer than brick walls. You run a car into a brick wall, and you run your head into a brick wall, and the chances are you won't come out well.
So you run a demographics into a brick wall, and the labor goes down. I get it. All right, makes sense.
But we have a choice to make in the history of our country. We can either go stagnant, like Japan has done and China is doing, or we can allow immigration and allow our culture to morph and continue to grow. We have a choice, and it's one of those critical choices in the history of a country. And it's crucial to understand that if we don't allow immigration, we don't pass immigration laws that allow more people to come in. I'm not saying illegal immigration, but I'm saying pass immigration laws that allow more people to come into the country. We will eventually have a very, very old population, mostly on Social Security and going broke. And Europe is headed that way already, to the point where Italy is now paying people to come and become citizens. China is probably at its peak population right now and will coast downhill from here. Japan has already hit the peak and is going downhill, and it's a lot of elderly people. And we have a choice. We can either bring in young people from outside the country, or we can stagnate and die and become an also-ran. And I prefer that we continue to bring in people from outside the country. But there's xenophobia also sets in as countries become prosperous. They don't want to share their prosperity with other people. And it takes we've passed some laws. We passed some laws towards the beginning of the 20th century, allowing more Europeans to come into the country, specifically targeting Eastern Europeans, because Henry Ford and others lobbied really, really hard to get more people to work on the assembly lines because there simply weren't enough people. During the 1920s, we had a fall off in birth rates in the United States. Basically, the late 1800s, early 20th century, we had a fall off in birth rates in the United States. We had a lot of people die from, I started to say COVID, from the 1918 flu. We had a terrible recession, and Henry Ford went to Congress and said, we need to have more immigrants come in. And he managed to get laws passed allowing more immigrants to come in. I think we need to look at that today, or we're going to run into a brick wall, like I said.
Yeah, and that means that if we're concerned about what immigration would bring to the country, then we design a law around what we would like to see come into the country. What our immigration laws right now are broken in every direction. There's not a Republican or Democrat that would disagree with that. They're just broken. The act of enforcing them causes the world to look at us like we are really horrible people. And at the same time, not enforcing them means that we don't have any control over anything that's happening. What really needs to happen is the immigration laws need to be rewritten so that there's a demand from business that hasn't been filled by U.S. labor. It's from the perspective of economics, it's very simple. From the perspective of politics, it's absolutely impossible. And that's where you are. We do have some other questions that are hanging out there waiting.
And we haven't hit everything in the market yet.
Oh, let's do that.
There's an anomaly in the market that a lot of people are trying to explain, and I've done a lot of research on. I'm sure you have too. The yield on the benchmark 10-year U.S. Treasury note. Now, most of you have probably never bought a 10-year U.S. Treasury note, but it's still the benchmark for everything else in the bond market, and it's a strong indicator, like the S&P 500 is not the whole stock market, but it is a strong indicator of what's going on in the stock market. It fell another 4% to 1.228%. That's the lowest since February. February was pretty low. Now, it's still up about 34% from the beginning of the year, but it's down 30% from its high in March. That's really weird. The fact that the economy is humming along, we're going to talk about that some more. We just had GDP reported is coming in at 6.5% on an annualized basis for the second quarter. The economy is going great guns. Theoretically, people are afraid of inflation. Technically, 1 year consumer price index was up 5.7%. Normally, that would cause interest rates to rise, and what it's doing is instead interest rates are falling. And that's something we can talk about in some detail.
Well, there's actually a question on that subject.
There's hanging out there. Yeah, we want to get to that. And finally, we follow the price of West Texas Intermediate crude oil because it's another indicator of where the economy is going. And it just ignored all the news, slowly rose during the week on increased demand. It's at $73.72 for a 42-gallon barrel. It's up 2.15% for the week. So we look at all of those indicators and say, these are what a lot of people with a lot of money think the market is, think the economy is doing, and it's reflected in market prices. So that's the market.
All right. Well, we've got three questions hanging out there at the moment. We've only answered one of the questions that have been asked. John asked two questions, one about the China-Saudi oil deal, and another about negative rates. So I'm going to jump the gun and go around the first question to the second one because it's on a subject we were just talking about. John says, negative rates. Why do people keep investing in negative rates when U.S. investments pay positive returns? Is this lack of knowledge or non-availability? Do they just not have access to the market? And that's a fantastic question. And he sent a copy of or a picture of the Wall Street Journal, as he does. Nearly $16 trillion of global debt tracked by Bloomberg Barclays had a negative yield as of July 22nd, meaning investors are locking in a loss by holding it to maturity. Okay, so why are they doing that? When the U.S., you were just saying, well, their interest rate has dropped, but it's still a positive rate. It's still 30% over what it was a year ago. How is this not a good idea? And this is a really good question. If you look at the exchange rate between the euro and the dollar, you'll see that last year at this point, the euro, you could buy a euro for about $1.13. And the exchange rate today is $1.17. It's a five penny increase on cost. It's not quite 5%. It's a little, it's right around the 4% mark as an increase. So a 4% change in the price of the euro against the dollar. The euro is up 4%. If you turn and buy a dollar denominated bond, that just based on the conversion rate drops 4%, and it's paying, what is it paying now? 1.3 something, is that what you said?
1.228%.
Okay, so 1.228%, but you lost 4% on the exchange rate, you still have a negative yield. So exchange rates get really complicated. If you're buying in euros, you get a negative yield on the U.S. Treasury right now anyway.
Well, the dollar has risen about 3.3% this year, and that has caused a rush into treasuries, because if you're from somewhere else in the world on average and you're using your local currency, converting it to dollars, you did it in January, and you bought into the U.S. Treasury when the interest rates are relatively low, your treasury note or your treasury security may be worth less today than once you bought it because interest rates have risen since then. But you've got a 3.3% kicker on average. So you actually are making a profit based on currency exchange.
Right. So at the beginning of the year, the euro was trading at $1.21, and now it's $1.17. So just depending on when you buy, that's an extra layer of risk, though, and why people are not flooding out of the European markets into the American markets is because exchange rates may change
at
any moment.
They actually are pouring into U.S. equities. And the other thing is, if you said, why hang on to treasury security from Germany, let's just say, a Bund, when it's got a negative yield? Well, the answer is, if you're German, and there's a lot of people who are German,
I'm glad they speak German there, or they'd have nobody to talk to.
Germany is the foundation of the economy. Germany's economy is the foundation of the euro economy. If you're in the European Union and you're buying with euros, there's a tendency to buy and hold locally in the United States as well as in Europe and every place else. Well, not every place else. Some places, all they want to do is get the money out of the country. China is one of them right now.
Would you like to hear the very technical bias name that the behavioral finance folks and behavioral psychologists have come up for that bias based
sure.
on locality? It's called
I'd love to hear it.
The locality bias. Isn't that crazy that they would come up with such an original name for that?
Well, there's a lot of truth in it, because you can sense and feel and have a degree of possession of your local currency.
Right.
People in the United States tend to buy U.S. securities far more than they buy foreign securities. And again, it does add a layer of risk. And you're buying something for 10 years and you're going to hold it for 10 years. It adds a layer of risk to it to buy it in some foreign currency, because that's an additional layer of fluctuation. The dollar could fall at some point. Anyway, yeah. It's time for commercials.
We got to play some commercials, and we'll be back on the other side. But if you'd like to join the conversation, we still have a couple of questions hanging out there that we'll get to hopefully this hour. Email addresses are jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. That's Tango, Papa, Whiskey, Charlie, or The Personal Wealth Coach. And we will be back on the other side of these vitally important messages from our sponsors. Back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach with Jake and
Jeff
McClure. We have another question from John. China recently made a deal with the Saudis to buy their oil for 20 years with currency other than dollars. Will this challenge the dollar as the global reserve currency? Okay, Let me kind of address that across the board. China and Saudi Arabia have a preliminary deal to buy oil for the next 20 years. It's not a treaty. It's not even a contract signed. It is a basic agreement that says, yes, we're going to continue to buy from you. They have been buying directly from Saudi Arabia and Iran and some other places for quite some time. How they're buying it is a big question right now. And your question says currency other than dollars. When Saudi Aramco became more than just a governmental entity, that's the big oil production company in Saudi Arabia, in their prospectus, they talk about a petrodollar or a petrocurrency or possibly using yuan-based bonds for purchase of oil and refined products. What is this? Well, if this is a little bit complicated, but we were just talking about exchange rates, so let's just go in whole hog. The yuan is not traded on the international markets very much. The yuan is the currency of China. It's also known as the renminbi. Both names are appropriate, but the yuan is mildly easier to say. So the yuan exchange rates are a little weird. It's hard to bring yuans out of China, and even it's hard to bring them into China. So they have the market pretty well closed up. So when they're offering to buy in currencies other than the dollar, it's a currency that doesn't properly exist yet, or ever, maybe. And the Saudis went through a pretty tough patch. They and the Russians got into a snit in the middle of the beginning of the pandemic, where they went into a full-on oil trade war, trying to put the frackers out of business at the same time as each other.
It's important to also notice the current situation in which this deal, this preliminary deal, was announced. As a Reuters has a headline, China's Saudi oil imports plunged 21%.
Now that's basically that is from June, but if you look back at the exports in July, they're up 147%. So go ahead.
The point is that China buys oil from Saudi Arabia. China would prefer to do business other than in dollars. Fact is, the Russians made a really sincere effort to buy oil for something other than dollars, and it never worked out because there isn't enough around. And oil is priced in dollars, and the Saudis, not being particularly stupid, would prefer to have a currency that's stable and backed by a large economy, backed by the full faith and credit of a large economy. And if they may accept yuan on a limited basis, it would be a small amount of money, relatively speaking, in their big economy. And the reason that they would accept that money on a limited basis is because if they can use it to buy things from China directly. But as far as it displacing the United States dollar as a currency, no, there's no threat there whatsoever there, right? Because there just isn't another currency that has the stability and circulation and quantity and quality that the dollar has.
This is part of the Chinese Belt and Road project, where they build infrastructure and give loans for infrastructure elsewhere in the world. And the deal for Saudi Arabia was, we'll give you a bunch of money, and the money is denominated in payback terms in the yuan, but it wound up being dollars being loaned. So it gets really weird in the middle of this. So the dollars flowed into the Saudi system. It's being paid back not with money. How's that for weird? They've been given a big loan in yuans that actually wound up being dollars when they arrived, to be paid back with petroleum products. So how about exchange rates there? We've got commodities being used as a currency in the middle of that exchange.
It's basically about as effective as using barter instead of money.
Right. And it
barter works between two nations.
It works well if you have a large amount of it. And if the Saudis were buying a whole bunch of stuff from China at the same time, the theory is that they could skip the dollar completely. The problem is that the Saudis have a bunch of debt that's dollar denominated, and they've got to pay on that debt. And so when they got the debt from China, they couldn't use the yuans to pay the dollar debt. So you can see why the replacing of a global currency is a very long process. And there's simply not enough yuans to do it at this point. So the threat may be there for some point in the future. This deal is not even the beginning of the pebble slide that causes the avalanche. This is just a pebble that just fell. And that's the numbers here are very small as a percentage of the overall international currency demand for dollars.
There's a parallel to that. There's people who want to replace the dollar with the Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And that was its intent, was to replace dollars. And the problem with that is, with the Bitcoin price fluctuating all over the place, crashing and then soaring and then crashing and then soaring, there's way too much risk in using Bitcoin in regular transactions. Instead, it's a speculative item. It's a collectible.
Yeah, it's a collectible.
A limited number. And as long as there's a market for it, there's a market for it, but it has no intrinsic use right now. You can buy a few things with it. But it's very risky when you go to buy something, because you can get a bid price for something, and then when you actually go to buy it, it could be much higher because the Bitcoin went down.
Yeah, so
the transaction has to happen instantly.
And people talk about, well, this company or that company is adding the ability to pay in Bitcoins. As fast as companies are adding the abilities, other companies are removing it because they got burned somehow. So it is not the established next step from the dollar. We don't know what that is yet, or if it is anything. We have one more question before we wrap up the hour, and we only have a couple of minutes left, so let's hit it quick. This is from Tom. Thanks for the psychological explanation on investing. Can you tie in the psychological effect on the new news and conversations and uptick in coronavirus-infected individuals and an increase potentially in people getting vaccinated? Also, what's the predicted percentage target needed to where we can move on? The number for herd immunity has been the same across epidemiologists, across every pandemic, epidemic, plague, whatever you want to call it, going back. And that herd immunity is right around 70% of the population, either having had the disease or being vaccinated for it. So that's the move on number. It's not perfect. Yeah, the cows are related here somehow. And if you want to look up how vaccines started, by the way, vaccine comes from the word cow. Vac in Latin is cow. And it comes because of cowpox replacing smallpox, that if you got the oozings from cowpox and injected it in yourself, you wouldn't get smallpox. So that's where the word vaccine comes from. It's nice. The economy is going to be stumbling for a while. We're still growing quickly. We're not out of the woods yet. Next hour, we're going to be talking about what happens on Monday when the moratorium on evictions and foreclosures goes away. There's going to be some major impacts to the economy based on that. The Delta variant is very likely to slow down demand for retail establishments. So we'll talk about that more next hour. This is a much bigger question than we gave it time for this hour. Sorry, Tom. We'll get to it in detail. It's a good question. What are the implications psychologically and otherwise of the conversations about the Delta variant? But we're about out of time.
We've had some really good questions this hour.
If you would like to talk to us off the air, we have voicemail waiting locally at
254-947-1111.
And should you still have a landline, you can go to that same voicemail at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. We've got recordings of the radio program. We've got links to podcasts. You can sign up for our newsletter, read our newsletter. You can use the Contact Us form. You can also email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. We read those things, and generally we answer them. So until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.